Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Item one, the Federal Reserve kept short-term interest rates really low today. Item two, that means money is still really cheap and will be for a while, which leads to item three. Isn't that how the housing bubble got started? Oh, also item four, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the Kirby bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by SunGard, 1,600 universities and colleges teach and manage 10 million students with software from SunGard Higher Education. More information at sunguard.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 4th of November today. Ben Bernanke and his colleagues at the Federal Open Market Committee wrapped up 2 days of conversations this afternoon. The general topic was the state of the economy. The specific agenda item was something called the federal funds rate. It's how the Fed controls the cost of borrowing. Right now, the U.S. Central Bank and many others have pushed those costs to record lows, all in the hopes of getting the global economy going again. In this country, it's 0.25%, but easy money does create its own problems. This week, both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund warned that asset bubbles could be coming back. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
In the past year, gold prices have climbed 44%. Copper surged 50%. In Singapore, real estate is rising like it's Vegas in boom times. And in Hong Kong, one large luxury apartment's expected to sell for more than $50 million. So is this the beginning of another bubble?
As a general rule, no.
Michael Moussa is a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Moussa believes the global economy is already recovering much faster than most predicted. And in Asia, he says the expansion is well underway.
While the V-shaped recovery is still for the United States a forecast, right? The V-shaped recovery is for many emerging market countries already an economic fact.
So Moussa argues it makes sense for Asian stock markets to boom.
I don't think that in general, equity prices are substantially too high.
But many other economists warn bubbles are notoriously hard to spot, especially before they pop. Ralph Bryant was director of international finance at the Fed.
It's very difficult.
Bryant says just think back to the housing boom.
For every person who was expressing doubts, there were probably three or four who thought that it was the natural evolution of housing prices, that they would gradually go up forever and ever. So we should be pretty humble, I think.
But Bryant says if central bankers raise interest rates to pop bubbles before they form, they could kill off any recovery. Instead, he says, the world needs much better banking regulation. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
That last line of Steve's piece, the bit about more regulation, that happens to be exactly where we're going right now. The House Financial Services Committee started wrestling with the Financial Stability Improvement Act today. It's supposed to coordinate changes to government regulations for everything from banks to stockbrokers and rating agencies, the whole ball of wax. And yes, that is a lot to cram into one piece of legislation, but Congress has had more than a year to work on it. It's been 14 months since Lehman Brothers collapsed, and the legislative sausage-making has left some wondering whether anything is going to make a real difference. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The House bill sets up a Consumer Financial Protection Agency and a Council of Regulators to keep an eye on risks to the entire banking system. But some reform advocates say there are too many loopholes and exemptions to really change business as usual on Wall Street. Heather Booth of the grassroots Americans for Financial Reform fears special interests will defeat real change.
This is really a David and Goliath fight of enormous resources from the Chamber of Commerce and the largest banks and the financial industry against Main Street.
But Booth is optimistic Congress will protect consumers from risky financial products and will find a way to unwind struggling big banks without taxpayer bailouts. Douglas Elliott watches reform efforts at the Brookings Institution. He thinks the legislation will force banks to set aside more reserves so they can survive hard times.
That makes a major difference in how safe financial institutions are. That is virtually certain to happen, and it's very important. If I could only do one thing, that's the one thing I would do.
But reform advocates criticize lawmakers for not taking stronger action against powerful big banks. At a press conference yesterday to kick off his committee's deliberations, Chairman Barney Frank seemed a bit defensive.
People have said break them up. Well, I don't know anybody who can tell me in the abstract how to break them up.
He said the new systemic risk regulators will have the power to stop any big bank behavior that threatens the economy. For reform advocates, the question is, will they use it? In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you took a pass on gold a year ago, back when it was around $800 an ounce, you're probably kicking yourself right now. Gold touched $1,095 an ounce today, thanks in large part to India. Earlier this week, the International Monetary Fund announced that it had sold a whopping 200 metric tons of gold to the Indian Central Bank. Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports now on that sale and why India is so keen on the yellow stuff.
Back in September, the IMF announced it was offering about 400 metric tons of gold for sale to the world's central banks. Most cash from the sale will fund an endowment to cover the IMF's operating costs. None of that was surprising. But when India scooped up half the gold, that was a surprise.
200 tons of gold is a very large transaction.
That's David Kotak of Cumberland Advisors. He says India's purchase sends a positive signal to investors who are bullish on gold.
If India would buy 200 tons, we could maybe expect somebody else to do it. If institutions raise their appetite for gold holdings, that is likely to drive the price much higher.
But India may also be sending a negative signal that it's worried about the value of major currencies, especially as central banks around the world pump new cash into their economies. Mike Levy is president of futures firm Canon Trading.
Those central banks figure out that if they take this money out of the system again, it's going to cause more havoc than anything else. They might decide to keep it in the system and create inflation.
One hedge against that? Gold. Cumberland's David Kotak says there's evidence some Middle Eastern institutions have been secretly squirreling away gold for a while now, and some experts speculate China might step in to buy the remaining 200 or so metric tons of the IMF's gold. I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Just because I know we'll get some comments on this, we did when oil hit its high last summer. The $1,100 price for gold is not a record once you remember inflation. The $875 or so that an ounce of gold hit 25 years ago works out to about $2,200 in today's money. New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo had way bigger numbers in mind when he filed an antitrust suit against Intel today. Cuomo accused the chipmaker of paying billions in kickbacks to maintain its dominant market share. Intel said in a statement only that it is going to defend itself. Investors said, man, we got to buy that. Intel shares were up 1.25% despite the news of the suit. The major indices, not quite so lucky. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Analysts are still digesting the results of yesterday's off-year elections. They've got a couple of governorships, some seats in the House of Representatives, and a whole bunch of statewide ballot measures to chew over. In Ohio, after nearly two decades of saying no to casino gambling, voters have decided to roll the dice, if you will. They're going to bring casinos to four cities, Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, and Toledo, to help get the economy going. From Cleveland Public Radio, Dan Moulthrop has our story.
Voters here have said no four times since 1990. This time, it all came down to money. Well, money and jobs.
Issue 3's four casinos will create 34,000 jobs, keep $1 billion in Ohio, and construction will begin immediately, providing an instant jumpstart to the economy.
Which all sounded pretty good to 53% of yesterday's voters in the financially strapped Buckeye State. One of those voters was Pentecostal pastor John Coates, who had lined up against previous gambling proposals.
With there being 11% unemployment in our state, there's no way that I could look past the 34,000 jobs that this effort would bring to our state.
The jobs were one thing, but casino backers said Ohioans were also taking $1 billion a year out of the state. One of those backers is Dan Gilbert, the guy who created Quicken Loans. He also happens to own the NBA's Cleveland Cavaliers. And so last night, celebrating the casino issue's victory on the Cavs' home court, he reminded supporters why he believes Ohioans supported this proposal.
They wanted casinos in urban cores that would spark development. They wanted jobs. They wanted new construction. They wanted the taxes to stay local. And we're going to make sure it happens here.
After spending $30 million on the campaign, Gilbert and other developers have promised to spend another $1 billion to construct the four casinos. They may still face some hurdles, however. Opposition groups are pushing for one more ballot measure that could force the casinos to face a local referendum in each of the four cities. In Cleveland, I'm Dan Malthrop for Marketplace.
Once upon a time in Arizona, there was this thing called new home construction. It was a huge part of the economy. It helped make cities like Phoenix one of the fastest growing in the country. Now the cranes and the backhoes have all but vanished from the desert. The missing construction money is really being felt, and cities and home builders each have very different ideas about how to replace it. From KJZZ in Phoenix, Peter O'Dowd reports.
The town of Queen Creek collects $16,000 every time a new home sprouts up from the desert floor. They're called impact fees, and they may not sound sexy, but John Cross says the fees essentially built this old farming community 40 miles southeast of downtown Phoenix.
Make sure I don't hit any nails here.
Cross is Queen Creek's town manager. He's navigating his car down a busy road that dips into a desert wash. It's prone to flooding, and impact fees were supposed to fund a six-lane bridge here.
This is delayed. It's an unfunded project.
During the state's real estate boom, Queen Creek grew 20% a year. All the impact fees that followed helped build libraries, bridges, and sewer plants. But now that new home permits are down 90%, Queen Creek is having trouble paying the debt on those projects. The town has resorted to raiding its general fund to pay its $8 million annual bill.
So that's really shaking the foundation.
Communities across Arizona face similar shortfalls. Gary Birnbaum is a real estate attorney and an associate dean at the Arizona State University College of Law. He says without impact fees, cities are handcuffed. They have no way to build parks or police stations without draining their reserves.
So where is the money going to come from? The answer is still always the same. It's the general fund. And that means more taxes somewhere for somebody.
Home builders say impact fees stymie business in a recession. Warren Peterson is standing in this virtually empty Queen Creek development. 3 years ago, Peterson's company planned to build 478 houses here.
Right now, there is about, in the community, 27 homes built out, so it's got a ways to go.
This is sort of a sign of the times, empty dirt lots.
Yeah, we're glad they're not tumbleweed lots like a lot of places you see. They're nice and clean.
As he enters an empty house, Peterson says his problem is simple. Prices have fallen by half. This three-bedroom home could have sold for $400,000 at the market's peak. But now the difference between profit and cost is razor thin. Impact fees eat up 10% of his budget.
For all builders in general, it's that much more difficult to stay in business. It's just the taxes continue to go up.
Peterson says cutting fees could make the difference, and industry lobbyist Spencer Camps agrees. He says lower impact fees would jumpstart construction, the lifeblood of Arizona's economy.
Why is it not a good idea to generate new home construction and generate sales tax and generate job creation in this downturn? And that's obviously a concept that is contrary to many local municipalities out there.
The home builder lobby carries a lot of clout in Arizona, and recently the legislature froze any increase in impact fees for 2 years. This week, the League of Arizona Cities and Towns will decide whether to challenge that freeze in court. This debate highlights an even larger problem that has followed Arizona for years. Municipal budgets are built off the windfalls of housing bubbles that have a tendency to pop. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Coming up, high-pressure recruiting at for-profit universities.
We would email constantly throughout the day, text message, talk on the phone.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street was downright blasé about the Fed's decision to keep interest rates near zero. The Dow Industrials edged up 30 points today, 0.3%, closed at 9,802. The Nasdaq dipped 1 point, about 0.1%, ended at 2,055. The S&P 500 ticked up 1 point, a fraction of a percent, finished the day at 1,046. Investors welcomed more cost-cutting at Microsoft. The software giant announced it's cutting another 800 jobs. That's on top of 5,000 positions it deleted back in January. Shares booted up 1.8%. Today, Comcast reported better than expected earnings, but shares dropped 3%. Investors apparently didn't like the nation's biggest cable company having to discount subscription rates to keep customers. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.52%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. American Public Media presents Rising by Degrees, an American RadioWorks documentary supported by the University of Virginia's Batten Institute. More at AmericanRadioWorks.org. Want to know how to talk money with your tykes, tweens, and teens? Get tips on the Marketplace Money website. And to learn more about your child's financial future, stay tuned for our Marketplace Money's upcoming live show in Portland, Oregon.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Thursday. The Labor Department releases the weekly report on initial jobless claims. Happy anniversary to former President and First Lady George and Laura Bush. And although most people remember the 1979 backboard-breaking dunk of Daryl Dawkins, it was actually Chuck Connors of the Boston Celtics that was the first NBA player to shatter a backboard, November 5th, 1946. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We spent some time up at the top of the broadcast today talking about the financial crisis next time, what Washington is doing to try to stop something like the last 18 months from ever happening again. Commentator Robert Reich suggests the best new rule for Wall Street is actually an old one.
The five biggest Wall Street banks are even bigger now than they were before the Great Meltdown. Together, they hold over 40% of U.S. deposits. And they're raking in huge profits and paying fat salaries and bonuses as if nothing happened. The only difference is now they know they're too big to fail, so the government will bail them out if they get into trouble. And like a giant gawking adolescent who's just discovered he can crash the convertible his rich dad gave him and the next morning have a new one waiting in his driveway, the big banks will drive even faster and take on even bigger risks. Almost no one in Washington wants another bailout, but there are two very different ideas for how to avoid it. The administration would put any giant bank that's in danger of failing into a so-called resolution process, akin to bankruptcy, where the bank's assets would be sold off to pay its creditors. But that's no answer. By the time a really big bank gets into trouble, one that poses a systemic risk to the entire economy, it's too late. Other big banks, competing like mad for the same talent and profits, will already have adopted many of the same risky techniques, and the pending failure will already have rocked the entire financial sector. A better idea is to restore the Glass-Steagall Act, which until 1999 separated investment from commercial banking. No public interest has been served by allowing the casino, called investment banking, to merge with the traditional intermediary function linking savers to borrowers. In fact, it's caused nothing but trouble. Separate them, and investment banks would not be too big to fail because they couldn't use commercial deposits insured by the FDIC to place big investment bets. Separate them, and mortgage lenders couldn't resell mortgage debt as securities. They'd have to bear responsibility for defaults, which would give them an incentive to carefully investigate credit risks before making a loan. Reenact Glass-Steagall. Not exactly a rallying cry, but it should be.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Drop us a line. Tell us what's on your mind. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. President Obama turned to education today. He dangled $5 billion in grant money in front of states that are willing to line up their priorities with his. That's mostly K through 12 education, of course. Yesterday, we were talking about higher ed, for-profit higher education specifically. The biggest for-profit university in the country, the University of Phoenix, is fighting a lawsuit. The suit says the school cheated taxpayers out of billions of dollars, money that came largely from federal student loans. It's just the latest in a series of claims that for-profit schools use deceptive tactics to get people to sign up. Our story, reported by Marketplace's Amy Scott and Sharona Kutz of ProPublica, continues now. Here's Amy.
It might start with a click on a banner ad or maybe an online competition to win an iPod. You fill out some personal information, and then the calls start.
They were very persistent.
She called me every day.
I legitimately got 3 or 4 calls a day for about 2 weeks until I finally talked to them.
Catherine Clark, Teresa Barron, and Daniel Ray are just 3 of the many students around the country who tell a similar story. They've been hounded by enrollment counselors from for-profit colleges. Anyone familiar with the sales profession will recognize some of their hard-sell tactics. But ProPublica and Marketplace have uncovered several instances where recruiters crossed the line. One tactic? Win the target's trust.
We would email constantly throughout the day, text message, talk on the phone.
Kat Clark was a student at the University of Phoenix in Long Beach, California. At first, she had a great relationship with her enrollment counselor.
Yeah, we just had barbecues and stuff together. And
did you feel that the friendship was genuine?
Yeah, I don't really think it was like a genuine thing. I think it was more of a, this is my job and I'll do anything to make sure that I get paid.
Enrollment counselors do get paid based at least in part on how many students they sign up and how long those students keep coming to class. That's legal as long as pay isn't solely based on recruitment. The company says frequent contact with students is about supporting them. Bill Pepicello is the university's president.
Certainly we want the students to believe that we are acting in their best interest, but it's certainly not by developing personal relationships.
But another student told us a University of Phoenix counselor buttered up her grandmother. Jewel Calderon lived in Fayetteville, North Carolina. She says the counselor told her he and grandma had what he called church over the phone.
He said he prayed with her over the phone, and he told her what his mother was sick and that they prayed about that. And he gained her trust, which made me gain his trust. And that's why I decided on that college as opposed to others.
Calderon ended up taking out close to $12,000 in government loans. When she and other students started having problems with the school, the friendships they'd developed with counselors evaporated.
Hey. Hi.
Brandon Burke lives in Portland, Oregon. Until last December, he worked as an enrollment counselor at the University of Phoenix. He says managers taught him and his colleagues a number of strategies to trick students into signing up. One ploy was to create a sense of urgency.
One thing we would be told to do is call up a student who was on the fence and say, all right, I've only got one seat left. I need to know right now if you need me to save this for you. Well, that wasn't true.
In the training session, Burke says staff asked the manager what to do if that student showed up for class and there were only 6 or 7 people there.
And a manager said, well, you tell them that the class got so full that we had to split it.
So you were basically told to lie?
Yeah, we were told to lie.
Burke wasn't the only counselor we spoke to who says managers told them to lie, and we've learned that Phoenix isn't the only for-profit school that's used these tactics. Brandon Burke says managers encouraged him to bend the truth in other ways, too.
People would say, you know, I saw the CSI, and, you know, I want to do that.
Good luck, David. We got 3 GSWs, 1 for the left kidney area, 1 for the left thigh, and...
Burke says he got frequent calls from fans of the popular TV show. He says supervisors told him to steer them to the criminal justice program. That might qualify them to work as prison guards, but not as forensic criminologists. But one of the biggest complaints students had was that counselors misled them about credits.
One of the things that we were told is you say we're regionally accredited, which means that they're transferable anywhere, which isn't true. They're eligible for transferability.
In fact, it's up to each school to decide whose credits they accept, and in many cases, University of Phoenix credits don't transfer. Burke says he never misled students. He left the company in disgust. Two former counselors from another campus sued the university, claiming they were pressured to sign students up. Last week, the company announced it expects to cough up more than $80 million to settle that case. But the university says it doesn't train its counselors to lie or to mislead students. Harris Miller is CEO of the Career College Association, an industry lobby group. He chalks any wrongdoing up to a few rogue employees.
If these accusations are correct, then the appropriate authorities should investigate them. And if it's true, then my response is hang them high.
Miller says higher education is a heavily regulated industry with oversight by federal and state authorities as well as private accreditors.
The fact of the matter is we're educating over 2 million students and focusing on a few wild allegations and a few documented instances of violations of the law is not the way to describe the career college sector.
But the sector has been in trouble before. In the early 90s, the government cracked down on hundreds of for-profit trade schools for abusing student aid programs. Barmak Nasirian represents college admissions officers. He sees many of the same abuses today.
The MO has not changed over the years. We have one step at a time over the course of the past 15 years removed all of the provisions that together momentarily cleaned the system up.
Congress and the Department of Education are looking at the rules again. The Obama administration wants more people to go to college. Congress poured more than $15 billion in stimulus money into college grants. Advocates welcome the investment in higher ed, but they also want change. They say without it, the system will continue to benefit for-profit companies more than the students they're supposed to help. With Sharona Coots of ProPublica, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, you've seen those Verizon ads, right? The ones that show one of their customers talking on a cell phone with a coverage map superimposed above their heads. And then next to them is an iPhone user with a much weaker AT&T coverage map. Well, AT&T is suing, says Verizon's ads are causing them to lose, and I quote here, incalculable market share, which is funny because I always thought making things worse for the other guy was kind of the point of advertising, right? That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow bumped up 30 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ lost a point, barely a fraction of 1%. The S&P 500 gained a point. Vahan Belladunni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, oh, those coin collectors.
A lot of them are not boring, but they are quiet and introverted. They're usually very smart.
Do they have problems getting a date?
Some of them. Some of them.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.